Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Mary Jane Rubenstein. She's a professor of religion, feminist gender and sexuality studies, and science and society at Wesleyan University. And we're talking about her new book, Pantheologies, Gods, Worlds, Monsters. Mary Jane, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
This is one of those books. I sort of picked it up not really knowing all of what it was about, and then found it out is essentially about everything. Are you typical for writing books about everything? Is that your passion?
I do tend to, I think, tell big stories, both in person and when I go to teach and when I go to write. I've been told, I studied in the UK for a while, and I've been told it's a particularly American way of doing things, that rather than go for one small problem and really go deeply into it, I tend to think fairly laterally and go for big things. The book that I wrote before this one was about the possibility of multiple worlds. And then when I got to this one, I realized, oh, I'm doing it again. I'm writing another book about everything. Next time, I don't know. I'm thinking about
it. Oh, no, do it again. I thought it was very French that you did this. But can you,
thank you,
to give people a sense, and you're also funny in an interesting way. You're humorous, let me put it that way. Read the first paragraph of your acknowledgments. It's funny. I picked up the book. I read that first paragraph, and I sort of go, wow, now I know what I'm in for reading this book.
Gosh, I guess I should have put more thought into the acknowledgments.
No, okay, it's perfect.
Here it goes. Much like the god worlds it thematizes, this book is the product of a polyphonic and indeed multi-species cosmogonic effort. Although its shortcomings are the collective responsibility of the riot of organisms currently decomposing the author, the work at hand would have remained a set of disincarnate weird ideas were it not for the companion species, gut bacteria, and quantum interactions that have fortuitously concressed into those remarkable humans who have helped me bring it into being.
That was just perfect. It was amazing. And this book is about pantheism. And give me a definition of pantheologies, because this gets to some very important issues about humanity and religion and science.
Sure. Let me start with a definition of pantheism, and then I'll go to pantheologies,
sure,
if that's okay. So pantheism, minimally speaking, is the idea that the universe we are in is itself what we mean by God. The universe is God. That's it. And that all of the functions that we attribute to God, which is to say creation and sustenance and redemption and destruction, that these are all features, these are all functions of the universe itself. So that's what God is, pantheism. Different from polytheism, which posits many particular gods. Different from monotheism, certainly, which posits a god outside
right.
the world. Pantheism really just sort of identifies God in the world.
And it's always, can I stop you? It's also different
yeah.
from atheism, and I want you to talk about that difference.
Sure. Well, it may or may not be different from atheism. So,
okay.
It is at least etymologically and syntactically, it's different from atheism. So atheism would mean the affirmation of no God, either as a sort of positive stance, which is to say, I swear there is no God, right? Or just a sort of privative sense, which is to say, God doesn't mean anything to me. I don't affirm a God. Pantheism, on the other hand, does affirm positively the divinity of the cosmos. It says that the natural world, again, that's around us and that we are also part of and that we are in, that is God. It's not just that, there's no God outside of it. It's that there is divinity, and that divinity itself suffuses the natural world, both the physical world and the ideal world and their kind of connection. So pantheism would be different from atheism. The criticism, though, tends to be, if what you're saying is that the world itself is God or the universe itself is God, depending on how you want to use those terms, if what you're saying is that the universe is God or the world is God or that nature is God, why don't you just get rid of God? Why don't you just say the universe is great or the universe is awesome, right? Why don't you just believe in the universe? Why are you making things unnecessarily difficult for yourself by adding God?
Right. It seems like you're adding an extra layer of stuff there that exactly. doesn't need to be there. And, yeah, and what's your answer to that?
It's actually, I think it's the first major problem that I bring up with respect to pantheism, and it's the last one I hang on to, because there are a ton of objections to pantheism that we can either go into or not. But this, I think, is the most lasting one, is the possibility that it might be that pantheism is just... Arthur Schopenhauer calls it a euphemism for atheism. Like, it's a polite way of being an atheist, to say, like, I just think everything is divine. I just think, you know, nature is divine or something like that. I think that it's a perfectly valid critique, and that if one wanted to claim that pantheism really just is effective atheism, fine. But I would want to ask why one would be interested in collapsing pantheism into atheism. Is it because the speaker has an interest, some kind of interest in the political stance of atheism or in an aesthetic stance of atheism, and wants to claim the pantheist for their team? Uh-huh. Or is it out of some, you know, concern for, say, monotheistic orthodoxy, to say, like, well, you don't get to be anything in between a theist and an atheist. You have to choose your side. And if you're not going to be a traditional theist, you don't get to be an anything else theist, right? So I'd want to know where the charge is coming from and what's motivating it. But either way, I think that if one were a committed pantheist, and again, I still haven't quite gotten to what I'm trying to say by pantheologian rather than pantheist, but if one were a committed pantheist, I think one could respond in a number of ways. I think one is, look, there's an affective or an emotional difference between being an atheist and being a pantheist. That the atheist, as an atheist, it may be that the atheist also has other commitments that force her in different directions, but the atheist as an atheist might not be sort of ravished by the beauty of the world around her or horrified by the suffering of the world around her. Whereas the pantheist, who affirms all things as somehow participating in divinity, often does claim a kind of wonderstruck reverence for the natural world, for even what we would call sort of the supernatural world. That's pretty different from the atheist. And this wonderstruck reverence, I think, often also translates into, you know, outrage at the abuses of the creatures of the world and the, you know, the natural world around us. So that's one. You could say there's an emotional difference, an affective difference
An atheist and a person who's a natural historian, I would say that I know I feel emotional about the natural world and the way that the universe works. But I don't put that other layer on it. But I do feel, definite strong emotions about it. But okay, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
One of the fascinating things, and starting a little back from the beginning, because there's other major questions I want to talk to you about too. When you set out to write this book, you found out that there were no really good histories of pantheism.
Right. Yeah. I
find that really hard to believe.
I know, it's really bizarre. There are a couple. I don't want to minimize the work that those scholars have done, but there are very, 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 very few. And for the most part, people just don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. Well, and this was astonishing to me.
Well, let's follow that through, because that's a thread I want to lead to, because it seems like in earlier writings about pantheism, it was a term used to, and this is in your own terms, to dismiss or ridicule. Right. And a great example in your book is Pierre Bayliss's screed against Baruch Spinoza.
Right.
And talk about that, because as a matter of fact, his term was that what Spinoza was talking about was monstrosity and chimerical lunacy, which you quote in your book. Why did everybody's, you know, get bent out of shape about the idea of pantheism.
Great. The idea of pantheism is said with remarkable consistency and, you know, throughout centuries, really, from Pierre Bayle on, to be monstrous. This particular word keeps recurring.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, my understanding of it is that what it means to be monstrous is to combine categories that, say, rational, sane thinking would keep separate from one another, or even opposed to one another. So the pantheist's major indiscretion here, and I mean indiscretion in both senses, that it's, there's something sort of shameful about it, and also a failure to keep things discrete from one another. The pantheist's main indiscretion is to conflate, to equate God and world, which, according to classical theism, are the most profoundly opposed terms imaginable. I mean, God is not the world. The world is not God. God creates the world. The world is totally dependent upon God. God is eternal. The world is temporal. God is infinite. The world is finite. God is just everything. The world is only something. God is independent. The world is dependent, right? God is unchangeable. The world is changeable. Everything imaginable turns for the classical theist around this difference between God and the world. Incidentally, this difference between God and the world then also tangles up all of these other kinds of associations. So just as the God of classical theism tends to be associated with reason and with light and with disembodiment and with a kind of masculinity, the world tends to be associated with the opposite of all of those things. So with emotion and with darkness, with a kind of femininity. And so there's the kind of, you could call it just the sort of straightforward theological problem of conflating God and the world. You know, how dare you say God is the world or something like that.
Right.
But it seems to me that the bigger issue is the visceral problem of identifying God with all of the crap, pardon me, that usually gets foisted onto the world, which is to say femininity, darkness, materiality, changeability, all of these categories that the Western metaphysical tradition has roundly at least inferiorized, but really demonized throughout its long trajectory. So that's the issue. It's the seeming glorification and even divination of these nasty, dark, feminine, material terms.
Now, I just want to make sure that I understood the book correctly, because it is a complex book. But one of the things I got out of it is that there's this, when these authors would use the word monstrous, it's because boundaries are blurred. And that goes back to an early Greek definition of what a monster is, where it's often like creatures that are of several different kinds combined into one.
Exactly.
And Pan, who often had contrary elements, you know, fascination and fear. And it seems like there's a real gut reaction against things that aren't clearly delineated, that anything that sort of blurs boundaries and defies hierarchies is what is behind this gut reaction you talk about the fear of pantheism.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And you know, we can look to ancient examples of this, say in the Greek god Pan, who incidentally is the god of nature, right? Which is to say the thing that's divinized in this pantheism. And this is, I mean, this is that we can track just usages of the prefix Pan here. Pan, the god of nature, is he's a goat, he's a man, and he's a god. So he's all of these things at once. He's an animal. He's a human. He's a divinity. All kind of smushed together into one. He doesn't live on the mountain on Mount Olympus with the other gods. He kind of like sneaks around in caves and forests and things. He's kind of liminal. He's in between spaces.
Right.
And the really fun thing about Pan is that he is said to inspire panic in people. And in fact, the word panic comes from the god Pan, that Pan would show up to terrify the enemies of his followers and scare them into submission. Or Pan would instill a kind of panic of adoration and sort of frenzied dance among his followers. So that kind of both like the visceral and the reverential, both of these valences of panic actually come to us from Pan. So yeah, it does seem like even this, you know, very early literary tradition had a sense of, say, the panic that blurred boundaries tend to inspire. And I do think that we can see this in the literary record that follows and reacts to this position that it calls pantheism. For a contemporary example, I think you can think about the sort of ongoing debates over what's called like the bathroom scandal.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Right. The question of who gets to use, who has access to which restrooms, and what it is that provokes such absolute outrage and panic in people when, you know, a sign goes up that says that something is an all-gender restroom. One of my friends on Facebook a few months ago wrote, "You'll realize you have all-gender restrooms in your houses, right? Like what is happening?" Something about the public nature of these crossed boundaries is inspiring this very familiar kind of, one could even call it like a kind of queer panic. Right?
It is. Yeah. It's also about the sort of hierarchical attitude towards a traditional divinity.
Right.
That there is like the crown of creation and we're sort of the chosen part of creation, and then the rest of nature is underneath us. And right. You talk about this very well, that pantheism throws that out the window.
Right.
And right. And therefore that engenders a panic too.
Absolutely. Right. So it's not just the two, right? It's not just, say, the male and the female. It's the whole, what is known in the history of philosophy as the great chain of being.
Right.
That this God outside the universe is said to hold in place. As you probably know, Genesis 1 tells us that humans are made in the image of God. Male and female, he created them. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. But then Genesis 2 says that God created Adam and then took Eve out of Adam. So then the question becomes, well, are men and women equal? Are they not equal? Are they both in the image of God? Are they not in the image of God? Lots of different answers to this. But St. Paul gives us what becomes the definitive answer, which is, right, what I want to explain to you is men are in the image of God. Women are in the image of man, right? So we start getting this kind of We've got God, and he even says God is to Christ is to man, as man is to woman, and we have this whole analogical order of submission that runs from the Father to the Son to man to woman to, you know, mammals to sea creatures, to land creatures, to sea creatures, to bacteria, to rocks and stone, to trees, to rocks and stones. The whole animal, vegetable, mineral world can get drawn into this this great chain of being, and the whole thing is held in order by again this opposition, this ranked opposition, as you're saying, between God and the world.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Mary Jane Rubenstein, professor of religion, feminist gender and sexuality studies, and science and society at Wesleyan University. And we're talking about her new book, which has all of that in it, all of that. Pantheologies, Gods, Worlds, and Monsters. We're going to run out of time before I even get anything talked about. One of the things that I thought was a really fascinating discussion in your book was the problem of evil.
Right.
And pantheism. Talk to me about you could, if the world is divine, if everything is divine, does that just make us numb to things like the horrors that hurricanes can bring? Or when somebody's eaten by a tiger, for instance, or a crocodile. I mean, what? And you discuss this really, really well in a very nuanced way too. Talk to me about the problem of evil in pantheism.
Right. Okay. Thanks. So classically, the problem of evil is a shorthand to designate the horror one encounters when one gets to the strange paradox that we have an infinitely good and powerful God on the one hand, and a highly flawed, suffering creation on the other hand. The problem of evil is, how is it that an omnipotent and benevolent God could allow so much suffering to take place in his creation? Right? If God is all-powerful, why doesn't he prevent evil? And if God is all-good, why doesn't he want to prevent evil? Right? How do we, so the sort of nasty threeness here, that the three elements that don't seem to be able to fit together are God's omnipotence on the one hand, God's benevolence on the other hand, goodness, and then evil, of course, on the third hand. So theologians undergo all these contortions to try to figure out how the hell you can get together God's all-powerfulness, God's all-goodness, and the reality of abject, horrible suffering at the same time. And we get terrible answers. We get
horrible answers.
Oh, horrible, right?
Right, you're not supposed to question. The thing that's always, since I was a kid, has frustrated me is you don't question it because that's God's way and God knows somehow has got a plan.
Absolutely. Yep,
so, and you can't understand it because you're just mortal and underneath God.
And that is the overwhelming answer. It's something like, well, God knows what's going on, and whatever looks like suffering from our perspective won't be in the perspective of God, because it can't be, because we have this commitment ahead of time to saying that God is good. So from my perspective, it's actually that sort of theological, what's called a theodicy, from the Greek, which means justification of God. That theodicy that says there must be a plan in this is actually, that actually performs the condoning of the conditions to say, like, well, I guess there's got to be a plan in here somewhere, and instills a kind of quietism, kind of refusal to do anything about it, because we've got this assurance that, you know, if God, there's a representative, I think, from Michigan, who right after Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Accord was speaking to some of his constituents and said, look, I, as a Christian, believe in an all-powerful God. If there's really a problem with climate change, God will do something about it. So this is, I think, what the problem of evil classically understood leads us to, and I think it's terrible. So the pantheist, on the other hand, doesn't have the commitment ahead of time to a single, all-powerful, all-good in the way that humans understand goodness to mean God, right? So the existence of evil in the world isn't—it's not a philosophical problem. It's not a problem to be explained away. You don't have to do the gymnastics to say, "How do we get together this all-powerful, all-good God with it?" Because you don't start from the anthropomorphic God who looks like a human king and a really nice dad. You don't start there, so it doesn't become a problem. Now, this isn't to say that what we call evil, or, you know, what I'd prefer to call just, you know, excruciating suffering, isn't itself a problem for thinking, for activism. Of course it's a problem. It's a practical problem, though. It's not a problem to be sort of reasoned away. It's a problem to be approached. And from my perspective, if we affirm that the force of the creation of the world, the stuff that creates the world, worlds, multiple worlds, is all here at hand and everything participates in it, then we can see very easily how different interests pull us in different directions, how different forces are going to inveigh against different forces. And we can decide, as participants in all of those processes, what kinds of worlds we would like to make and what kind of communities we would like to make, rather than stepping back and saying, oh, well, I guess it's all sort of part of some divine plan. This is very different. The critique of pantheism is usually something like, oh, well, if you say that everything is divine, then you're saying that this, you know, cancer cell is good. But that's not the case, right? That's not the case unless your pantheism happens to say that divinity has to be understood as good in the way that humans understand good. I think the problem really comes down to a tendency to anthropomorphize God to such an extent that God has to look like A, us, and B, has to have our interests in mind, right? What's good for bacteria and for beetles and for, you know, termites is not necessarily what's good for us. And if we think really pantheologically, we have to think about all of these different creatures and different interests and different goods in competition for one another and try to figure out what, you know, where we go from there, right? Rather than thinking from the outset that our interests have to take precedence over everybody else's.
Would you say that pantheism, therefore, not only allows for but encourages activism?
It depends on your pantheism. So this, okay. And this is the reason that I wanted to shift the term from pantheism to pantheology, not because pantheology means anything. It's clearly a neologism, but just because I wanted to get clear that I was finding constructive and helpful work in a particular flavor of pantheism that doesn't get a lot of playing time. There are lots of different ways to think about pantheism. William James gives us this idea that there are really two major strands of pantheism. One he calls monistic pantheism. That's the kind of pantheism that basically says everything is one, we're all part of one big mind, and we're all the same, and we're all the blah, blah, blah. It's very hippie, isn't it? Sorry, I can't even speak like a normal person when I talk about that kind of pantheism. we're all getting drawn into the same, you know, the make me one with everything kind of pantheism.
Okay.
That pantheism, I think, actually instills a quietism, perhaps even worse than ordinary theistic quietism.
Right.
Because the idea there is, you know, we are all participants in one unchangeable, perfect, eternal order. It's kind of like the Greek Stoics were this kind of pantheist. So there's just nothing we can do to change anything because everything taken as a kind of enormous totality is divine and therefore perfect. So I don't see a lot of critical possibility in that kind of monistic pantheism. James also talks about what he calls a pluralistic pantheism. The idea there is we've got like all these kinds of divine agents working with one another, working against one another, working separately from one another. It's this pluralistic, sort of multiplicitous riot of world makers, world destroyers, world sustainers. And to think pluralistically there, I think, is a lot more helpful, because then we start to realize that we participate in the very forces that create and decreate the world. So that's a much closer stance to something like a position that I think leads much more naturally to something like activism, certainly than the monistic pantheism.
Mary Jane?
Yeah. Yes.
We're out of time.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. And I knew we weren't going to be able to do this book justice in just 27 minutes, but unfortunately, we're out of time. I hope listeners realize that there's a lot in this book, and it's really, yeah, there's a lot of large ideas and a lot of interesting history, but it's really worth reading. My guest tonight is Mary Jane Rubenstein, professor of religion, feminist gender and sexuality studies, and science and society at Wesleyan University. And we're talking about her book, Pantheologies, Gods, Worlds, and Monsters. Mary Jane, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
I'm going to have you back to just continue the conversation. And seriously, it's like, and this is great. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.